from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Buying a coffin, organizing a memorial, making sense of estate taxes, these are only a few of the chores one is faced with when a loved one dies. We'll talk to Scott Taylor Smith, author of When Someone Dies, A Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death, and he'll join us along with trusts and estates lawyer Jim Mitchell. We'll talk about death's logical to-dos. That's next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Nothing, at least for the present, may be as certain as taxes or death, but preparation may be a lot easier and less of a shock for the former than the latter. And you might ask yourself from time to time, what are the practical things you need to know when someone dies, someone close to you or someone you care about or someone whose death really requires you to take a role? That is the subject of a book by Scott Taylor Smith, written in conjunction with Michael Castleman. He's a partner at VN Capital, and he joins us in this morning's second hour. Welcome. Good morning.
Thank you.
And also with us is trust and estates lawyer Jim Mitchell, who is with Coblentz, Patch, Duffy, and Bass in San Francisco. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And this may seem a morbid subject, but frankly, in terms of public service, it's a very practical one. What do you do in terms of the logistics of death, and what do you do when it requires you to know what needs to be known to handle death? Let me begin, if I may, with you, Scott Taylor Smith. And you're a lawyer, and your mother died, as I understand it from your book, suffered a brain injury, and condolences for her loss back in 2009 up in Santa Rosa. And you, as a lawyer who actually had worked in with trusts and estates, thought this would be an easy task and found out quite the opposite.
I did. And it's funny because the decisions you have to make it's a cascade. They start happening immediately. For example, right after my mom passed away at her rest home, you know, the question was, what mortuary are you taking her to? And I had no idea. We hadn't even planned for that. And then when you get to the mortuary, they want to know how many death certificates you want. Now, I just assumed that one would be sufficient. And this very kind woman at the mortuary said, well, I actually think you probably need more than that. And I said, no, I only need one. Well, as it turns out, every financial institution, the post office, everybody needs an original copy of a death certificate. So if what I say is take the number of credit cards and sort of times it by two, and that's probably the number you need. But if you get them from the mortuary, they're very cheap and very convenient. If you wait and have to go back to the county, it can be very time consuming.
Talk about getting them from the mortuary. I was just talking over the weekend with a friend who said, you go to a mortuary now, and I've seen this on a couple of occasions, and we take MasterCard and American Express. I mean, can't help thinking about Jessica Mitford and the American way of death that become, in some ways, so much of a kind of mercantile and commercial crunch and so much to learn about what to do. In your book, I mean, it was overwhelming in many ways to realize just how much detail. And you have to navigate through this sometimes when you're in terrible grief.
You do. You're in terrible grief. And mortuaries, I will say this, most mortuaries are very ethical businesses, but they are businesses and they're in the business of making money. They ask you, pose you a lot of questions which you just don't know the answer to. For example, we knew that my mom wanted to be cremated. There was no question about that. But the mortuary people said, well, which casket do you want for the cremation? And they phrase it in such a way that it makes you think you have to have a casket. Well, you know, you obviously don't need one for a cremation if you're not going to be viewing the body and stuff. And then similarly, they show you a row of urns, you know, that start at a very low price and go up to an extremely expensive price and ask you which urn you want. And by state law, you know, you're not required to have an urn. By state law, they're required to provide you a compostable container. But those are the sorts of questions that you're asked very quickly right in the worst moment of grief.
There is a lot to deal with here. And this is not a book about grief, although you do mention C.S. Lewis's A Grief Observed, which is an excellent book. And I would second that recommendation. But when you think about funeral homes and banks and the IRS and Social Security, I mean, it can be overwhelming. But you talk about it early on as really part of the grieving process.
Well, it is. It is. And one of the things that we recommend is that when someone is starting to die, particularly if there's time, to sit down and write the obituary and start talking about some of the things, planning the memorial and stuff as part of the process.
And let me bring you into this, Jim Mitchell. We talk about executors and trustees and power of attorney. You can learn a lot of this online. But the fact is, you should probably have a living will. And if you want to have a trust lawyer, you ought to get one pretty soon. I mean, in terms of particularly somebody whose mortality is fading.
Well, certainly, it's one of those things that people would just as soon ignore. It's not a pleasant subject.
It's a verboten subject.
but certainly, in terms of making things easier, there's still quite a bit of navigating, as Scott found out and relayed in his book. But certainly it's helped by planning, by taking steps, at a minimum getting advanced directives and dealing with issues, or at least having the conversation with loved ones, and then putting your affairs in order at an appropriate level for the complexity of your affairs and your estate.
One of the things that surprised me in reading Scott's book was, if you are, as he was, the executor, you have to be paid a 2% fee. And you get fined if you don't get that. Isn't that right, Scott?
Well, it's not. You don't necessarily get fined, but they really urge you to take the fee because it sort of confirms the relationship. And what I did with my family, I have three sisters, and we agreed that I would take my fee and donate it to charity. So we donated it to my mother's favorite charity.
Well, you also had some problems with your siblings, about whether you should have a Catholic or a Buddhist ceremony. I mean, these things get into some, especially when you have a family of a number of children, get into some pretty heavy-duty things. In your case, in fact, your mother was, so I understand it at least from your narrative, your mother was at first pronounced a goner, and then she kind of came back. And so it was a difficulty about should we give her morphine? Should we keep her alive? All those kinds of things.
She lingered for 10 days sort of in and out of consciousness. And one of the issues that we had was one of my sisters, who is a devout Buddhist, she's a Buddhist priest, really wanted to limit my mother's morphine because she wanted to be able to have a decent conversation with my mother if my mother was capable of doing it. And it became sort of an argument about whether we didn't know whether mom was going to die or whether she would recover. All the doctors were saying that the extent of her brain injury was pretty clear; she would never recover. But I not only was her executor, but I also had her medical power of attorney. So ultimately, the decision came to me.
Jim Mitchell, let's talk with you about probate. The common wisdom has it: if you got money, you should look at probate very differently than if you don't have money.
Well, I think that's a fair statement. I mean, in general, my client base and the cases that I'm working with, I really do take all steps possible to avoid going through the probate process. In general, the need for a probate proceeding, which in certain cases can make sense. What you've got is going through the court process and having the court oversee all aspects of the administration. And, where there is a need for having a purely objective party oversee and administer the estate or oversee the total administration, that can be good. But, in many cases, the administration, even for significant estates, can be pretty straightforward, and there's really no need to have the court oversight. The court is always there if there are concerns or if a beneficiary wants to bring it in, but in general, using a revocable trust or living trust to avoid having to go through the court process is desirable.
I mentioned a moment ago about the possibility of getting fined. Glad we cleared that up. If you're 2% of the executor, but you can get fined if you don't report to Social Security.
Well, the Social Security, the Social Security Administration, in my experience, is pretty efficient. Once you do notify them, and generally, they will. Both provide information in terms of decision making for survivor benefits and spouses, and paint the options that are available pretty clearly. But as Scott points out, they will also reverse any payments and advances that have been made directly to a decedent's account quickly and retroactively back to the date of death. And so it's important to make those contacts and check that off the list.
And also to go to the bank as soon as you can, Scott. You
know? Yes. Yes. No, I made the mistake. My mother was receiving her Social Security by direct deposit to her bank, and I didn't know I was responsible for notifying Social Security. So we continued to collect her payments for a couple of months. And then when I finally notified Social Security, they took all that money back, plus a fairly significant penalty for it.
Well, look, we're talking about what some would not necessarily consider the most happy subject, but nevertheless a necessary one and one very important to public service. And you may want to join us. In fact, if you have questions, I invite you to do that right now. Our toll-free number is available, and we welcome your calls. That number is 866-733-6786. We're talking to the author of the What to Do When Someone Dies, about really the logistics of death. And a lot of it, of course, is preparation, but, you know, buying a coffin, organizing a memorial, making sense of estate taxes, these are only a few of the chores that you have as tasks when a loved one dies. And we've got Jim Mitchell with us as well, talking about, well, his territory, which is trust and estate law, which he's been in for 25 years with Coblenz, Patch, Duffy, and Bass. And again, if you have questions, you can join us right now. The toll-free number is 866-733-6786. And you can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And, of course, you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. What else would you just recommend, Jim Mitchell, in terms of preparation for an event, especially with a loved one that nobody wants to necessarily contemplate, but that in reality we all face that grim reaper, although I had Ray Kurzweil on, you know, who is part of the Singularity Project at Google, and they're going to maybe vanquish death. Eventually, Google has everything else, so why not do that? But in the reality of and the grand scheme of things, if there is a grand scheme, preparation.
Well, yeah, preparation and also communication, kind of leaving a trail, I guess. So speaking with those who you expect to carry out your wishes. So whomever you've named as executor, certainly whomever you've named in your advance directive, you know, it's an opportunity to communicate your wishes. And so there's less question after the event, after the fact. Organized financials and putting things together in terms of maybe even a list of who your advisors are, where important documents are located, you know, the significant assets, really just giving someone a roadmap to help smooth the administration, I think is.
Yeah, Jim, we consider this really critical.
Scott Smith.
And we sort of call it the Thanksgiving dinner conversation. But, you know, you really want to find out if somebody has a medical directive, if they have a power of attorney, where their will is, who they've appointed as the executor, and also where title to all of the various pieces of property are. You know, if there's a car, if there's a boat, if there's real property, finding those documents and knowing where they are.
And also, Jim is talking about communication, Scott. What's the best way to inform people?
Well, right now there really isn't sort of a cloud-based service, but there should be to have these documents available online. Right now the best way is to just have copies made and to give your children copies or to give your spouse copies. And to also have some filing system at home where there's a big file that says, you know, at my death file.
Can we talk about some practical things, though, too, like removing the body and making sure that organ donation is taken care of, those kinds of things?
Well, organ donation is very important. And most organs have a very limited timeline. So you have to, you know, extract the organ and get them to the recipient very quickly. Kidneys, for example, I think have less than six hours, and hearts are about the same. So knowing if somebody has made it wants to be an organ donor is very important. Obviously, we encourage people to become organ donors. But if the deceased is not in the hospital, you're going to have to get them to a hospital or some medical facility where the donation can be made.
We have, as I expected, a lot of listeners with questions. So let me go to our callers. And again, you can join us toll free at 866-733-6786. First up, Kaylee. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me here.
I
have a question because I am actually a recipient of a trust, and I have an executor who is a family member that I'm not particularly close to, and I have received funds from the trust, but the executor refuses to let me know how much money is in the trust, so it's very difficult to make financial decisions.
All right, Jim Mitchell, some advice for her.
Well, as a beneficiary of a trust, well, certainly you're entitled to basic information. And so one of the things that you're entitled to is a copy of the trust document so that you can understand what the provisions are and the terms of the trust. And those could vary substantially. The other thing you're entitled to is information about the assets of the trust. And so any reasonable request for information, the trustee needs to respond to and provide.
And if he or she doesn't, you can take legal action, right?
Yeah, and you would hope that that would be unnecessary. And hopefully, what you might want to do is actually engage counsel in order to hopefully get the trustee to understand. Maybe they'll get counsel and understand what their responsibilities are. But there's requirements for accounting, at least on an annual basis. There's requirements for information. And what I'm talking about is a trust that's already been established for your benefit, which sounds like the case.
Sounds like you got the law on your side here, Kaylee.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Let me go to another caller, and that's Jerry. Jerry, welcome.
Hi. Yes, my question is, there's me and my two brothers. I have a mom who's had a couple strokes. She's doing fine at this point. But my question was, if something was to happen to her, say if she became a vegetable, there's no directive, advance directive in place, what happens if there's a decision that needs to be made based on her care?
I mean, who makes the decision?
Who makes that decision?
Yeah. Scott Taylor Smith.
Normally, the doctor of the hospital, if they don't have a known power of attorney, will look to sort of the siblings to help make that decision.
That's what happened in my case. There are three siblings came to a decision together. And that's, in your case, you had some division within your family, which is often the case.
Well, and you want to try to present unity with the doctors, with the medical staff. So the best thing is to take the internal conversation, family conversation, offline and then come back with a very clear view of a united family.
Good luck to you, Jerry, and thank you for the call. I want to get as many calls on as I can. John, join us. You're on.
Hi, yes, it's John Martin. I'm wanting to know about the 2% mandatory executive fee. What if you have co-executors? Do they share it, or does each get 2%?
Well, Jim Mitchell's shaking his head about this 2% fee. Are we off on a different course here?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to clarify that an executor can waive a fee, and so it isn't really a mandatory fee. That's the first point. Secondly, yes, generally it would be split. And the other fee that's involved, since we're talking about in a probate proceeding, is there is a statutory fee that's available for attorneys. I guess the final clarification is it's not a flat 2%. There's a sliding scale, and so it starts out at a certain percentage and then reduces. And I'm not obviously fluent in the numbers.
But well, we should state, by the way, just for the record, that neither of you are necessarily giving legal advice here. You're giving your opinion from your experience and from the research and work you've done. Yeah? Okay.
Thank you.
And we go to Oakland. Chris, you're on. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, two comments. One, my mother recently passed in Paris, and the system over there is quite draconian in terms of cost, but pretty straightforward. I mean, it helped that the bank we use, I'm in the fifth generation that's used the same bank, and the lawyers were in the fourth generation. So they were pretty good. But here in the U.S., I had a friend whose son ended up in 2 years of nasty litigation with his sister, who was the trustee of a trust, and wouldn't give him any information, wouldn't, give him any money, wouldn't give him any information, wouldn't give him a copy of the trust. And the lawyer for the trustee was completely unhelpful and did nothing but defend her client.
It's an awful story. I'm sorry about your mother, Chris. But again, it's your opinion, Jim Mitchell, that there would have been legal recourse there.
Yeah, even with a revocable trust and even where you don't have a court-supervised probate proceeding, when a trust becomes irrevocable after someone dies, there's an obligation for whomever is trustee to notify everybody named in that document and the closest relatives and advise them that they're entitled to a copy of the trust document. And thereafter, if you're a beneficiary of that trust, again, you've got a right to general information as well as a right to an accounting on a periodic basis.
Of course, this is a transatlantic story, though. I mean, it has a different twist to it in that sense. Scott, yeah.
But one of the most important things in this, in a battle like this, is to keep the try to keep it as emotionally neutral as possible. And so, you know, your sister or your brother may have huge emotional issues about the money with you particularly. So it's very smart to write a very precise letter, involve an attorney if you can, and keep it very professional. But if you do send that type of a letter, particularly if the other side is represented by counsel, they should make the person comply, because they you know, ultimately you want to avoid the litigation.
And good luck to you, Chris. Thank you for the call. We'll go to, again, as many of your calls as we can here. Let's go to Berkeley and welcome Diane. You're on. Hi.
Hi. Well, I just thought that it might be useful to some people to talk about how my remains will be disposed of. I've donated them to the World Body Program, University of California, San Francisco, and my husband also did this. And when he died in the hospital, the hospital informed UC San Francisco. They picked up his body, no charge. And the great thing is that your last act is to help science, and it's all free.
Scott?
Well, thank you very much. That's a great gesture on your part. And it is true that if you are an organ donor, the hospital will come and get the body and stuff all for free, because you're doing such a generous act.
And thank you for that call. We're going to continue taking your calls and emails. And again, feel free to join us. We're talking about what to do when someone dies. Really, a practical guide to the logistics of death. That's the title of a book by Scott Taylor Smith, who is an author and lawyer and venture capitalist at Vion Capital. Jim Mitchell is also with us. He's a partner with Coblentz, Patch, Duffy & Bass in San Francisco, and he's practiced trust and estate law for the last quarter of a century. And again, we welcome your involvement in the program. You can go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's at KQED Forum, or post any questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or email us, forum@kqed.org. All the lines are busy, as I expected they would be, but when one becomes available, grab one. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. What to do? The logistics of death, a necessary topic to talk about for public service. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Scott Taylor Smith, author of When Someone Dies, A Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death, is with us. That book was written with Michael Castleman, and Jim Mitchell is also here, partner in the law firm of Coblentz, Patch, Duffy & Bass in San Francisco. He's practiced trust and estate law for 25 years, and we're talking really about what to do when someone dies. I don't mean to sound apologetic about taking this up as a topic, but people always get strange reactions whenever you talk about things that are forbidden, and talking about death often is a forbidden topic. We were talking off air about the fact that people, Scott says from his experience, people feel they don't want to write out a last will and testament, because when they do, they think the next day they're going to expire if they I mean, these bring up all kinds of, shall we say, primal feelings, but there is a practical side of it, and that's what we're looking at. Let's go to your calls. Actually, I get some practical advice from Jane. Hi, Jane.
Hi, good morning, Michael. I'm so glad you are addressing the subject because, as you already said, it's a subject nobody wants to talk about. So for 8 years, I've been offering biodegradable caskets in the Bay Area, but more importantly, I want to bring people's attention to two products that they can purchase, which I don't think you purchase them. I think they're free. And it's called, one of the organizations is called Pulsed, P-O-L-S-T, and I picked up on this many years ago, and it's on bright, bright pink paper. And you need to get a copy of this and fill it in and have it with you when you go to the hospital. And it's so helpful for the doctors and everybody involved in your care so that they can explain to the doctors, you know, what your wishes are. And then people need to know they can die at home. They do not need to go to a hospital. And if they want to have a home funeral, as you've already had people on your show a few months ago, there are people in the Bay Area very happy to help you, so that you can actually take care of your loved one at home.
Yeah, there was a number of months ago that we did a program on alternatives to funeral homes and dying at home, and had a number of people on who talked about that whole issue. It was one of our part of our series of bringing people on who are listeners and who actually work in the industry. Laura writes, why do trusts always contain last name of the owner? Is it possible to name a trust with something other than a last name for confidentiality purposes, Jim Mitchell?
You can. There's no requirement that the name be in a trust. A trust always needs to have a trustee. And so, for those who want to maintain confidentiality, there's this kind of a sliding scale in terms of you can name the trust whatever you want, but somebody's got to be associated with it. Going to extremes.
There has to be a legal name on it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's a question on a website from a listener, Scott. Says, what do you do if an elderly family member dies at home? Has a doctor who will not come to pronounce, is not actively involved in a medical problem? Who do you call, coroner, mortuary?
You call a mortuary. If there's any question about the legality of the death, if there's foul play, then you have to involve a coroner, or the police. But otherwise, you just call a mortuary.
And as I hinted earlier, and Sally writes, I want to point out that you don't have to be an attorney to do most of this preparation. It's often a matter of organization and communication. And Rick says, what are the downsides or negatives to setting up a trust? Jim Mitchell?
Well, there's attorney fees might be the one threshold
big downside,
issue.
Yeah.
And there's also, a lot of people might think that just preparing the documentation and doing the trust is the end. In order really for the trust to be effective, you've got to follow through and take the steps in order to transfer assets in the trust, or what's called funding the trust. And so there can be a little bit of follow-up, a little bit of hassle involved, but generally banks and brokers and title companies and the financial community is well-versed, and this is really commonplace and the norm in California.
Let me go to a few more questions from the web and email before we go to more of your calls. A listener writes, I know this seems trivial, but when my loved one dies, most likely I will be on the other coast. When that moment comes, what is the best way to get a flight quickly without being charged last-minute prices, Scott?
That's a good one. Interestingly enough, most airlines do not have bereavement discounts. In fact, they take advantage of you, and certainly they do in the case of moving a body from.
I thought most did have to be no.
Very few do, but that's the only solution I would have is to try to. They have bereavement so that you can cancel a flight. In other words, if you want to cancel an otherwise uncancelable ticket, you can over a bereavement. But it's very hard to I don't really know other than to go on Expedia and look for the best deal.
Here's another question actually for you, Jim Mitchell. Stephen writes, could the estate attorney clarify when a trust is necessary for an estate and when it is not? My understanding is that if your estate is not too large, you have specified beneficiaries for all of your investment accounts and your children are already adults, then a trust is unnecessary. And how about the family home is the only piece of real estate?
Well, there are ways of titling and structuring accounts and other assets so that they pass automatically to designated beneficiaries. Similar with real estate, it can be titled in a manner that passes automatically to a surviving joint tenant. Or if it's a husband and wife owned property, could either be joint tenancy or community property with right of survivorship. So there are alternatives. Generally, trusts, the benefit of a trust is it provides more or less of a centerpiece for one's estate plan to make sure that all of those pieces are coordinated. Going specifically to the question, I think, however, there is an exemption and kind of a streamlined affidavit procedure for small estates. And currently the threshold for assets that are in an individual's name, aside from real property, if the total value of all of those assets is below $150,000, there's a waiting period of 40 days and then an affidavit procedure to allow for the transfer of those assets.
And let me bring on some more calls. Sue, welcome.
Yes, I have two questions. I have my trust completed, but because I'm 85, I checked through the trust and I found that my daughter's name, the last name, she kept the maiden name, but the lawyer added the married name or her husband's name. Now, would that be confusing or illegal?
I don't think so, no. As long as she's well identified.
Yeah, the critical...
In other parts of it, it's correct. There's just one part, and I can't remember exactly where it was.
The critical thing is that she's well identified, as Scott just said, and that there's no ambiguity in the document. And so if it's just a differentiation maiden and married name, my guess is that's not going to cause a problem. But you may want to circle back to the preparer.
And you had another question, Sue?
Yeah, I just want to know, is a power of attorney necessary when both children are in sync with everything and I do have a trust made?
Yes, it's still a good idea.
Oh, okay, so I have to go back to the attorney?
Well, what I would do is I think they're available online. What you want to do is you want to fill out an entire medical directive that actually tells people what you want done in various states and then couple that with a power of attorney.
Of course, your mother had that and she changed her mind.
She did change her mind. Yeah.
Jim, you want to add?
Yeah, there's when you say power of attorney, there's a distinction. There's actually two different powers of attorney. And one is for medical decision-making. So you're naming an agent, you're naming somebody to speak for you if you can't communicate yourself. There's a second power of attorney, and that's a power of attorney for stepping into your shoes and managing your property and assets and making financial decisions for you. So there are two different documents. There are both statutory forms that are out there that are available, but you really should consult with an attorney or it may be a good idea.
Jim, here's a question from Alex. He says, my father's estate was never probated and I lost my copy of the will. Did his attorney automatically file it with the county? What can I do?
Oh, that's a good question. There is a requirement in California anyway that anybody who holds an original will is required to what's called lodge it with the court. So even though there may not be a probate proceeding, there's a requirement that the will be filed with the court. Whether or not that happened, whether or not the attorney had the original will, those are questions that you need to chase down.
Well, we'll chase down some more callers. And Nick, you're next. Thanks for waiting. Join us.
Yeah, I would just want to call in. I recently attended a dinner in San Francisco run by a chef, Michael Hebb, and his organization, deathoverdinner.org. And they're leading dinners across the world that are what they say is it's addressing the most important conversation that we are not having. And I found the experience to be really
so that uplifting. The title of that would make me think of E. coli or something like that. Sorry.
Yeah, well, I mean, the headline is sort of let's have dinner and talk about death. And essentially they just talked about, you know, why we can't address the issue and with our friends and family of how we would like to die. And just all this kind of remove the stigma around talking about death. And I guess a related question would be, because I found the dinner not only provocative but inspiring. And what are other ways that you guys think could be impactful ways to remove the stigma around talking about death and addressing the important questions that we're not discussing.
Yeah, some thoughts on that, Scott Tyler?
Well, one thing is to do some to talk about some of the things that are less threatening than, for example, the financial issues. But to talk about, I was at a dinner party the other day where the question came up: what music do you want played at your memorial? And it was a fun question. It would let us all sort of talk about our favorite classical music or whatever. And that was a good prelude to sort of talking about other issues. You know, the biggest problem in most families is money makes somebody, if not everybody, prickly. And so you don't want to start the conversation with, you know, talking about dividing up the money.
Let me thank you for the call, Nick. Here's Chris, who writes, what about inheritance tax? Is there a way to minimize the requirements either within or not within a trust? Jim?
Well, certainly. Inheritance taxes can be a huge factor, and if you are in a situation where you're subject, you need to get some professional advice. The one thing that happened in January that Congress finally gave us what they say is a permanent estate tax legislation, and that raised the bar considerably in terms of making permanent a $5 million estate tax exemption for everyone. That's also one that's indexed, so it's already up to $5,250,000 that can be transferred either by gift or at death without any estate tax at all. The other thing that they changed was to allow for transfers where there's a transfer between spouses to allow the surviving spouse to use the first spouse's exemption. So that together, there's an exemption if the appropriate filings are made of up to $10 million and $10 million 5 index. And so that can make the estate tax is actually irrelevant for all but a very small percentage of the real world here.
This may seem like a kind of trivial question, but I've heard it come up from time to time. Scott, what about, say, closing a Facebook account?
Oh, closing your online personality or persona is very important. Facebook, for example, allows you to notify them, identify your relationship to the deceased, and then memorialize their Facebook page. And they allow you to write different rules for who may come and see the page and who may also make comments on the page.
Can you also include the music that you choose?
Yeah.
You said earlier.
MP3 file.
Mary writes, I wanted to add something I learned from experience. Those death certificates are expensive as well as awkward to obtain. Good news, you can actually request that the various agencies, institutions, etc., which require presentation of these documents, return them to you, including a self-addressed envelope with a self-addressed stamped envelope with a note. Almost all of them will do so. They really only need to see one copy that's the same. And the only exceptions for me were real estate-related mortgage holders. Even Social Security returned the certificate. I recycled several of them, and in doing, saved myself a lot of money, time, and effort. And Emma writes, I'm British, and at the current rate, I'll never get the time to become an American citizen. Does this have an adverse effect on me if my spouse dies first? Are there any other advisors' death effects?
There are some
adverse death effects, excuse me.
There are some special rules for non-citizen spouse in terms of the estate tax. Again, the exemptions are quite generous, and if you're at that level, you want to see an advisor. There is generally no estate tax where assets pass to or for the benefit of a spouse, but you need to jump through some special hoops where you're a non-citizen, again, if estate tax is at issue.
Our next caller is joining us from up in Ashland, Oregon. David, you're on. Hi.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. 10 years ago, I established a trust in California, a living trust. I'm the trustee. I now live in Oregon. So I'm wondering if there's any changes that I need to make to that trust because I live in a different state. And the second question would be, how do I make a change to the trust? Could it be a handwritten addendum that's notarized at the bank?
Jim Mitchell.
Well, the answer is maybe.
Now you sound like a lawyer.
Estate planning and the trust rules and laws are very state specific, and so changing residency from California to Oregon, generally a living trust it isn't going to change that much. It really depends on the specifics of your situation, but you might want to get it checked. In response to the question about making changes, You've got to look at the trust document, but there's no requirement generally for having a formal change. What you want to do if you're doing it yourself is make sure it's clear and unambiguous and follows the terms of the trust, and you do whatever is required, you know, for modifying that trust. But good idea to get it checked out, both for the change of state and residency, as well as just to make sure whatever changes you're making are going to be effective.
And good luck to you, David. Thank you for your call. I want to read some emails here with questions. Scott Sue wants to know, are there laws regarding transporting remains to another state, since we just talked about Oregon?
Well, there generally very few people are empowered to handle a body, and it's typically only government personnel or the mortuary. You know, one of the issues that comes up is if you – in my family's case, my sister, who is the Buddhist, there's a tradition in Buddhism where you leave the body in the home for a period of time, sometimes 3 days, sometimes 10 days, and the view is that that allows the spirit to leave the body gracefully and peacefully. So we decided to move my mom from the intensive care unit at her retirement home back to her apartment. And that required that we have the mortuary come out, personnel come out and do that move, because no one else is empowered to.
Zach writes, my mother recently passed unexpectedly, and to my surprise, she had multiple life insurance policies. How are life insurance taxes handled for beneficiaries?
Generally, life insurance it goes to a designated beneficiary. So when the policy documentation was done, the owner of the policy designates a beneficiary. Those typically come income tax free to a beneficiary. In addition, though, they may be subject to estate tax, again, depending on the ownership of that policy and the size of the decedent's estate. But generally, it's not going to have any tax consequences to the beneficiary upon receipt. Again, you have to check with accountants, tax advisors, and an attorney for specifics.
You're going to add something?
Yeah, well, no, that's an important point. Almost everything you inherit comes to you tax-free, but one big exception, which is if they're in a tax-deferred plan like an IRA or what have you, there are presumably going to be taxes due. Jim, you want to?
Yeah. IRAs and other assets that really have never been taxed, those have tax consequences to the participants. So qualified plan interests and other retirement benefits. This kind of leads to just something that I think should be clear, is a lot of people are under the misconception that their will govern the disposition of all of their assets. And that's not the case. The beneficiary designations on life insurance, on employee and retirement plans will, and often, as we discussed before, that how property is titled, how accounts are titled, may dictate who receives those assets at death. And the will doesn't operate on
those
like,
levels. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's, again, going back to advantages of a trust, if coordinated, that gives you one centerpiece for making sure that the aspects of the assets and their disposition is all integrated.
Yeah, Jim Mitchell is a partner in the law firm of Coblenz, Patch, Duffy and Bass. And we also have Scott Taylor Smith with us, the author of When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. And here's Greg from San Leandro. Hi, Greg.
Hi. I'm calling in regards to my grandmother just died, and when she had her home refinanced, no one ever told her that it needed to be put back into the will, into the trust. So now that I'm trying to buy it and it's not in the trust, is the only way to go is probate?
The
Jim Mitchell.
Unfortunately, it sounds like she put it in the trust originally, and then, as is not uncommon, in the course of a refi, title got placed back in her name, because oftentimes financial institutions want the borrower and the property owner to match up. And so it's not uncommon. You've got to check in a refi and make sure that gets back. Probably there will be a need for a probate proceeding to clear title to the property. You definitely should be talking to an attorney, getting some advice. There are some alternatives that may be worth trying, depending on the facts, something called a Hegstead petition that may be helpful, but you've got to get into the detail and get some advice.
Do you have any advice about finding a good attorney or the right attorney? I mean, you know, obviously, Scott Smith, we've got a good one, a couple of good ones here with us. But I mean, you know, put yourself outside of this for a moment. You're in Mongolia and you have to find a good attorney.
Right? The best way is to ask friends. If it's a foreign issue, then you really need to go to the embassy, to the U.S. embassy.
And we go to another caller, and that's Carol. Hi, you're on.
I'm calling in regard again to the POLST form because I wanted to add some detail that the woman who called earlier suggested. It stands for Physician Orders for Life Sustaining Treatment. And the key thing about it is that it must be signed by your doctor. The Advanced Care Directive, at least the one I filled out, did not have to be signed by my doctor. It also gives three types of medical interventions. I think, at least I used to think, there was either full treatment or nothing. And there is a middle ground, which is called comfort measures only. And this form is available online. And for anyone who doesn't have a computer, I strongly suggest that they ask someone who does to print it out. It's one page, and you can go to a Xerox store and get the pink paper. It's bright pink. It goes in your file with, and you should, and it has a little card also you can carry in your billfold. I feel much relieved that I have filled this out, and I've suggested it to several friends. In addition, I learned about this maybe through your program. There was an organization called CompassionAndChoices.org, and again, they give many wonderful pieces of advice to people who are dealing with end-of-life decisions. So definitely get the POLST, P-O-L-S-T form. You will feel very relieved if you do.
Again, good practical advice, Carol. Thank you for that. Appreciate it. And we'll go to another caller. Deborah, you're on. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share with the audience, in my mother's case, the funeral home in Sebastopol did contact Social Security for us, so we did not have to do that. And secondly, she was on a very limited income, and when I found out how the payments worked, I thought we were going to have to pay back her September payment, but that was actually her August payment. So Social Security does pay a month in arrears.
Thank you for that information. What about paying the funeral home? Can we talk about that for a minute, Scott Taylor Smith?
Yes. Well, although this sounds cruel, you actually are not obligated to pay for the funeral expenses of a relative. If you obviously can, but you're not required to. And we've all heard the phrase sort of a pauper's grave and stuff. I mean, if nobody wants to pay for it, the county will actually pick up the tab for that.
And what about the decision you were alluding to this earlier about cremation? When does that come in, or how is that made?
Well, in most important, as part of the conversation you have about where are the documents, where's the will, where's the title to the car, is to talk about what kind of arrangements the person wants after they die. You know, do they want cremation? Do they want to be at the ashes distributed somewhere specific? You know, burying a body full of formaldehyde or whatever in the ground is a very toxic act. And for those of us who are green, doing a cremation is a much better way to treat the planet.
You were talking before about dinner conversation about what music, you know, would be played. It would actually be an interesting hour to ask listeners what music would you like at your funeral. But there's also people plan their funerals now, you know, and then there are people who have life celebrations in lieu of a funeral, old-fashioned funeral. But, you know, I mean, I've heard people say, I just don't want so-and-so giving a eulogy at my funeral. I mean, to some extent, there ought to be preparation, shouldn't there? I mean, again, in terms of what all that we're talking about here?
Oh, there should be preparation. We should, you know, we should all talk about this with our loved ones about what type of event we want. You know, if you're religious, your religion probably dictates some aspect of it.
But then there are a lot of people who don't want religion, you know, although it's been very much a part of their family and so forth, yeah.
Well, we knew my mom would want her memorial to be a celebration, to be very celebratory. So we purposefully delayed it for about 6 months so that we were out of our really core grief. And we invited, I think, 200 or 300 people to come. And it was a really spectacular event.
And how did you resolve the split between the Catholic and the Buddhist?
Well, we brought my mom back to her apartment, and we finally settled on, I think, one day. But she stayed in rest for one day, and we had dry ice, so she was, you know, comfortable and everything. And then we had her transported to the funeral home, and she was cremated.
Well, if you want to learn more about the subject, and it is, as I said, a subject that... if you have a loved one who, presuming they are mortal, you may want to know more about just the practical things to do. When Someone Dies, A Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death, written with Michael Castleman by Scott Taylor Smith. He's also a lawyer and venture capitalist at Vienna Capital. Thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Important hour. And Jim Mitchell also with us this hour, partner in the law firm of Koblenz, Patch, Duffy & Bass in San Francisco, who has practiced trust and estate laws for 25 years. Thanks, Jim, for your expertise.
Thank you.
And thank you, our listeners. We would not be here without you. Tomorrow during this hour, we're going to lighter topics. I guess we're going to meet the two stars of the musical Beautiful, which is at the Curran Theater. That'll be for the first half hour, and they'll be here with us in studio. That's all about Carole King and her life. We'll also have Richard North Patterson on with us, who's written a new book. Takes place in the 60s, all about loss of innocence, and, you know, leading novelist and best-selling novelist who's lived for many years here in the Bay Area and well-known here in the Bay Area. Thank you for being with us. I want to extend thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. You can also continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.